Pleased to have with us today Dr. William Kirwan. He received his BA degree from Johns Hopkins University in Psychology in 1963, his Bachelor of Divinity degree from Westminster Theological Seminary in 1965, his Master of Science degree from Loyola College in Counseling Psychology in 1971, Doctor of Ministry degree from Union Theological Seminary in Virginia in 1974, an Advanced Graduate Certificate from Loyola College in Counseling Psychology in 1976, and his PhD from St. Louis University in Counseling in 1982. He's been a licensed psychologist in Missouri since 1978. He taught psychology and counseling at Covenant Theological Seminary here in St. Louis and at Trinity Evangelical School. He served as a pastor, a counselor, and is presently serving as psychotherapist at Psychiatric Associates Incorporated, St. Louis, Missouri. Today he is going to speak with us on the topic homosexuality, theological, biological, and psychological perspectives. He has also written a book that is now in its sixth printing, Biblical Concepts for Christian Counseling. We welcome him to our campus, Dr. William Kirwan.
Glad to be here today and to be able to share this time with you. We have an awful lot to cover in 45 minutes, but we'll do the best we can. Originally, we were thinking of speaking on something like the centrality of the cross in counseling, but it seems to me that this particular issue, homosexuality, is one that is probably the biggest problem that the church faces today on a sociological level and on a congregational level. We hear a lot about abortion. We're going to hear more and more about this particular difficulty. How do we as Christians respond to it? Seems to me that persecution, which in the next 4 years could become something of a reality, probably is going to come along these lines. As you know, a number of years ago, about 10, I suppose, Bob Jones University lost their tax-exempt status because they wouldn't admit blacks to the school. They had what they feel was a biblical basis for that. While I think most of us would disagree with their theology and their reasoning, nonetheless, it does seem, and the higher court ruled in their favor, that this was a breach of church and state. But I can easily foresee especially in the coming 4 years perhaps, that if a church doesn't hire or admit to membership practicing homosexuals, that we would quickly lose tax-exempt status. And that would just be an early possibility, but one which I think is probably very real. So as a group of Christians together, all of us are going to, I think, more and more band together in the light of all the problems that we face in post-Christian America, to use Fran Schaefer's statement. We now live in it, and we're going to have to band together to survive. But this particular problem is going to become a big one, and it's one, of course, to which the Bible directly speaks. And probably there's no more powerful political lobby than the gay and lesbian rights groups. They have incredible power for being a group as small as they are. So now we go into all of this, the biological, the theological, and the psychological sides. I will primarily try to speak to the psychological side and the church's response to it. But let me just begin with the theological, and I was asked to comment on the statement that human sexuality statement that Missouri Synod has. By the way, I go way back. You know, when I arrived here in 74, you just had a tremendous difficulty here at the seminary being a Covenant. You know, Covenant and Concordia stood together. So we had all kinds of faculty meetings and get-togethers, and Ralph Bowman was then became president, and we got to know him and John Klotz. So I go back here a long way. We fought some real battles in those days, so I feel at home. Let's go to Genesis and the picture that's basically given us there. Number one is creation. And then God says it is not good for man to be alone, implying that man has social needs which are not being met and fulfilled. And so he creates Eve, and there is division. Male and female created he them. Now it seems to me that right there the debate stops. We have all kinds of papers, some of them written by evangelical Bible-believing Christians, that homosexuality is not condemned in the Bible and therefore is a viable lifestyle. But just right here, where you have sexual identity as a outgrowth of creation, seems to me that the discussion stops there. I'm sure you've heard the joke, it's so worn out, but God created Adam and Eve. He didn't create Adam and Steve. So you look at the tremendous differences between men and women, genitalic differences, differences in the hormonal makeup, differences in the brain. Psychosexual differences have now come to the fore. 15 years ago, you couldn't mention them. But as you see the beauty of men and women, how they're made, again, especially focusing here on the external genitalia, you see that they're made for each other. And that when you try to picture two men or two women in intimate sexual relationships, it's very difficult. And it's not a natural fit. So we have identity established in creation. Gender identity first. That is, I am a man or I am a woman. Each of us is probably pretty certain that we're men or women. That's primarily based on the anatomy which we were given in creation. Sexual identity, which is the problem we're speaking to today, is not as secure. So right here, the case from Scripture seems to me to be airtight. You can't, again, procreation, you can't have two men producing a child, you can't have two women producing a child, and so male and female created he them seems to me to be the end of the debate. You can then go on to Sodom and Gomorrah and Romans. I have a paper here that was given at the Christian Association for Psychological Studies a number of years ago, an exposition of Romans 1, where he's trying to prove that Romans 1 doesn't condemn or judge homosexuality. We've been bombastic, bombed by this stuff in our psychological circles for years, and frankly, one gets rather tired of it. Just to give you an example, in 1976 at our convention in Oklahoma City, it concluded with all of us being together, and we were being addressed by a Southern Baptist minister who was a gay, and he told about his experience, but he ended up by standing in the front and saying, "Now I am a born-again Christian, I am your brother in Christ, I am gay, now what are you going to do with me?" Said with great hostility and confrontation and arrogance. And you know, often we're accused, I have so many things I got to say and I'm just not going to say them, often we're accused of being homophobic. I'm sure if there was a representation from the gay community here right now, they would immediately be saying I'm homophobic. Well, the answer to that is they're heterophobic, and that's the end of that. You know, okay, maybe I am homophobic, but you're heterophobic. Let's talk about your phobia, since you always want to talk about mine. I don't think it's fair, or it's not right, for you to allow yourself to be backed into a corner. And you see, it's also manipulative, and it's just catchwords. But immediately, you're homophobic. And immediately, we're on the defense. We don't have to be on the defense, because they're heterophobic much more so than you're homophobic, as we'll try to go into in a little while. So, we have to respond, but on the other hand, we want to not be defensive about it. So creation, then reunion, and then the one flesh concept. Then moving on to Romans 1, I do think that that this is not a thorough exegesis of that by any means, but in verse 18, the bottom line is the psychological mechanism of suppressing the truth. For whatever reasons, man chooses to suppress the image of God, the knowledge of God that he sees in creation, and secondly, he moves on to worship the creature and serve the creature rather than the Creator, verse 25. That being the bottom line, then that leads to more surface things. We're working up here. Thirdly, their thinking, it became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So there we have a moral statement about man worshiping the creature rather than the Creator and suppressing the knowledge in the image of God. Then we come to this rather jolting truth that God gave them over in the sexual desires of their heart to sexual impurity. Verse 24. Verse 24, and then to verse 26, to shameful lusts. Then we move to verse 26 again. Women exchange natural relations for unnatural ones. And then in verse 27 and 28, there's no question about what he's referring to. In the same way, men also, inflamed with lust, had relations with one another. Out of a depraved mind, they were filled with every kind of wickedness. Now, what's interesting here is in all the 20 plus or minus sins that are described here in verse 28 and 29, he focuses on homosexuality as the end conclusion of men and women who suppress the truth and worship the creature rather than the Creator. Why? I think there's very telling reasons for that. God's plan, of course, was what we just saw. Male and female created he them. And then out of that comes the marriage and the family. So for this reason, a man shall leave his father, mother, cleave unto his wife. So the family, marriage. Now, those are the orders, the divine will, if you will, given in Genesis. Then, when we move into this, we have that being negated. Men are having relations with men, women are having relations with women. So the distinction between men and women now becomes blurred. So the family is gone, marriage is gone, the differences between men and women are gone, and I'm told that hinted at in Romans 1 is bestiality. So all the lines of creation are now blurred. Nothing else can go. And I think that's why Paul focuses on the homosexual sins as being the prominent one that shows a post-Christian society. Now, I brought this along, keeping it in a brown folder. I'm not going to open it up, but this is something that a patient brought to me about 2 weeks ago. She asked me to see it. There's a lot going on there, but it's this book by Madonna. I will just show you the metal folders. It's not for sale. But I, you know, after 25 years of this, I thought that basically I was beyond being shocked or beyond being moved by this kind of thing. I opened it up, and she asked me to do this. Get myself off the hook here. This was a tremendously important communication from this young girl who's struggling, a high school girl who's struggling with who she is and what is her gender identity, et cetera, et cetera. She's trying to communicate something very personal about her own guilt and badness and her confusion to me, the therapist. But she asked me to look at it, and I did so. It's 80 to 90% homosexual, whips and chains and all the rest, and I was shocked to open up, and there's a picture of a dog and Madonna engaged in activity, and there's the bestiality. And as I looked at it, I just had to say, this is
out of Sodom and Gomorrah. And, you know, we're going to have to apologize to them if we either don't have a revival or judgment doesn't come. In the Bible, homosexuality is always the doorway to judgment, and we're knocking at the door. So here's this book, available in most reputable bookstores for $50 a copy. Bestiality, homosexuality, you name it. It's one of the most depraved things I've ever seen. I sat there stunned, and after my initial response of being stunned and then very angry, I just became profoundly sad and said that to her. This makes me very sad. And of course, then we had to discuss what this meant to her. All right, moving secondly then from the theological, not that that's by any means been exhausted, but moving to the genetic. Here again, we come across our American culture and the shallowness of it. And most of the culture has accepted the gay line and the line now of society that you're born gay. It's in your genes. It's in your biological makeup. You're just born gay. And that kind of research led to this Newsweek of February 24th, 1992, is this child gay? An infant. Is this child gay? And of course, the intimation is that the child is gay, that you're born that way. Well, let me just say that the genetic evidence is overwhelmingly against the fact that we are born, the statement that we are born gay. That's an intimation that there's a sexual orientation gene, that there's just a gene inside of you that says you will be gay. Don't even try to be heterosexual because you can't be it. You're born that way and there's nothing you can do about it. There is absolutely no evidence to confirm any kind of a sexual orientation gene. Now, having said that, I do need to balance it out by saying that the research does show that there may be predispositions to some of the factors, the psychological factors, which then tend toward producing a gay orientation or a homosexual orientation. Let me restate that. There may be predispositions to some of the factors, which we'll look at in the psychological side in a moment, which lead toward a homosexual orientation. But these are predisposing factors. All of us, as we sit here today, are predisposed emotionally and psychologically. We're predisposed to depression, perhaps, to outbursts of temper. On the biological, on the medical side, we're predisposed to diabetes, to cancer, to heart disease, all of these things. We're all predisposed to different things, and all of us are predisposed to psychological patterns. Doesn't mean that we act on them, or it doesn't mean that they have to be there, but we're predisposed to them. So, quote, according to current available evidence, the sex chromosomes do not directly determine or program psychosocial status as heterosexual, bisexual, or homosexual. That's John Money from Johns Hopkins, probably the leading researcher in this area. And again, he says there's no sexual orientation gene. And again, when you take that on and try to refute that, you're going to be in trouble, because that's the thinking of our culture. Man's written a book, Reparative Therapy of Male Homosexuality, Joseph Nicolosi, and I want to refer to this again, but he did an interview with Barbara Walters on 2020, I think it was, and after a presentation of this book and some of the people that he has worked with, there was a scathing rebuttal, psychiatrist after psychiatrist, and judgment, and really putting him down, that why do we have to have this kind of thing? Why can't we accept each other? We're born this way anyway. And That's the psychiatric model. That's the way that all of behavior is viewed in our culture. It's chemically determined, and here's a pill to try to do something for it. So, biologically, there is little evidence except evidence that there is predispositions to certain factors. By that I mean, you know, I've had friends that were pro football players. I would love to have been built like that. You know, Mark Arneson used to be on the Cardinals, and he's in the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and Todd Worrell and others. And one of these men said, you know, Mark Arneson used to go out there in the football field, and he'd really knock heads and all this. And I said, yeah, if I had his build, I could do that too. But I don't have his build, and some people have been built very slightly. Build is a very strong determinant of how perhaps a father responds or how a mother responds. So there can be all kinds of biological predispositions which are then taken by the family and molded. So let me then turn to developmental factors as we move into the psychological. Now, human development, as we get into the psychological, I hope this is where we really want to concentrate. How are we doing time-wise? What time should we stop? Quarter after? Okay. Okay, here we get into what I do, psychoanalytic psychotherapy, and have probably six people that have this problem. We almost always have to go to twice a week therapy. It involves several years, and the patterns that you run into are just about the same in everyone who has these kinds of difficulties. Well, let's begin with development. Development begins with the infant being born. Now, let me say at that point, when the infant is born, there's already a tremendously powerful relationship between the father, between the mother and the child. They've been together for 9 months. For 5 months at least, the infant has been very conscious of all the things going on inside of that mother. If she yells, that produces screeching results down where he or she is safely tucked away. So when the infant is born, there's a tremendously powerful relationship, as I say, between mother and child. When my first two children came along, I'm 55 this week, so I don't look it. I know you can applaud for my youth, but when my first two children, who are now in college, were born, we weren't allowed to be there. You were ushered into the father's room, and there you got stuck. And you know, when the baby was born, you got a 5-second glimpse, and that was the end of that. Well, all of you are now allowed to be there. You can have videotape and take pictures and all this kind of thing. It's just, you know, that would really do me in, frankly. But we have a 10-year-old, and I was allowed in the room when he was born. And the first 4 minutes after birth, a child has some kind of power or ability to move, much more so. It goes very quickly. But you know, he was born, it was a boy, and they rushed him over to the cart where they give him these numbers and sort of clean him up. And I was at my wife's head as she was lying there, and they they brought Jason over and placed him in the crook of her arm as she was lying there, and I was back here. And all this noise, you know, the president of Psychiatric Associates, my closest friend, was there. Other doctors were there. We were all just joking and having a good time. And he seemed oblivious to this. None of it was phasing him. And then my wife spoke to him, and I could never forget it. He jerked his head around and looked at her. And say, this is in the first 4 minutes they can do that. And he knew that voice. And he knew that there was a relationship between them. Now, I point that out because it's very important, as we'll see in a moment. So we're born a tiny infant, but already a very substantial, very important relationship has been established between mother and child. Research shows that no one can replace the biological mother in terms of nurturing the child. One of our children is adopted, and it's just proven to be a problem over and over and over again, trying to work through that initial rejection. So as the infant develops, pleasure or the absence or release from pain is the only thing that motivates the young infant. Pleasure or release from pain, getting out of pain. But as the infant continues to mature, hopefully they move beyond pleasure and the release of pain or the absence of pain to more mature responses, behavioral responses which we would hope would lead to a relationship with Christ, being able to love, being able to receive love, being able to give, being able to be creative, to hold responsibility. And pleasure becomes a secondary factor, a second-order reinforcement, to use psychological jargon. In other words, pleasure, or the release of pain, recedes in favor of much more mature responses. And so, as we look at the homosexual problem, pleasure seems to be the main thing that is looked for and sought after in the homosexual relationship. And, quote, "Thus, to make pleasure of sexual stimulation, homo or for that matter heterosexual, the goal of life is to live continuously on an infantile level." So, number one, as we turn to the psychological factors in the homosexual schema, it's a very, very infantile behavior. Okay, that's extremely important. Now, two developmental factors here which are important, and they're important because we're trying to understand what produces them, the homosexual person. The newborn infants are biologically divided into male and female. This is a boy, this is a girl. Very, very few exceptions, occasionally persons born with deformed genitalia, et cetera, and they're sort of in between, but that is such a rare thing that it's not needing of our attention. So we're born either male, female, and the core gender identity is established at that point. Okay, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, and homosexuals basically know that this. Gender confusion is not the issue. Sexual confusion is, but gender confusion isn't. So masculinity or femininity develops as an individual uses the anatomy that they're born with, and then it's developed and related to in the family picture. So core gender is related, arrived at through, number one, the anatomy and physiology of the external genitals, the attitudes of parents, peers, siblings, mass media, education, the church. All of these then contribute to a homosexual orientation or a heterosexual orientation. So the anatomy is first, then that's introduced into a family setting, a school setting, a church setting, which then can either go for or against. And then what happens in the child's developing awareness of him or herself is the third factor in development. Now, let's move into the factors that make up the homosexual that you're going to be interested in. You're going to definitely have these people come to you in your pastorate. Here, this might be of interest. Just let me put this up. As we look at this, the overview in men, 10% of homosexual men, only 10% respond as having close relationships. And in those 10%, these were, quote, relatively monogamous or relatively less promiscuous. Now, lesbians tend to have closer homosexual relationships than men. And that's the caretaking, the mothering ability that women are born with. So only 10% of men respond as having close relationships. 28% of male homosexuals have had 1,000 partners or more. 50%, and this is an this 50% is an NIMH study, so it can't be accused of being biased, especially since it was conducted by gays. 50% had over 500 partners. Only 17% of male homosexuals reported fewer than 50. You know, therefore, 83% of white homosexuals had sexual relationships with 50 or more partners. Now, if you watched Rush Limbaugh last night, you saw him critiquing these Senate hearings for the cabinet, where they're lamenting the fact that there's so many more black and Hispanic people that have AIDS. There's probably a stronger homosexual orientation in those cultures. These are just white males. So the conclusion then is 79%, more than half of their, said that half of their partners were strangers. The rate of homosexuality, you're told, you know, this is, again, we hear it all the time. One out of every 10 of you out there is gay. If I was presenting a gay rights presentation, they really know how to do it. I know that your homophobia has your defenses up, but let them down. Just think with me. I'm playing a role here. Now, you do realize that probably the person next to you is a struggling homosexual. One out of every 10 of you is a closet gay or an active gay, and you just won't admit it, you won't face it. And then you see guilt, defenses are bashed, and on we go. Well, the rate of homosexuality, 10%. No. The evidence suggests that less than 3 to 2% of males in a given year are practicing homosexuals. Less than 3, maybe no more than 2. The sustained involvement, those males that have sustained involvement over a long period of time in the gay community, less than 5%. Female homosexuality is significantly less. Therefore, when you combine the men and the women, it is less than 3%. Now, there's all kinds of studies to back this up. This is just a summary of the statistics. I don't need to tell you that, number one, the homosexual people tend to be very, very depressed. There's a tremendous rate of depression among the homosexual population. And this is often what brings them to us, because they're finding no fulfillment in their lives. So there's a very high degree of depression. Secondly, they're very lonely. Most of them feel very alienated. And you see, this is something that's been ongoing. The homosexual male usually feels around the age of 7 for sure, and probably earlier, that he's different than other males. At recess, he tends to not get involved in the rough and tumble sports, and he may be over here doing something different, but he feels different. By the way, if somebody comes to you in your church and says, if they're able to get it out, and hopefully we've communicated from the pulpit that it's all right to come and be open about your problems, if they feel trust and trust you enough and have seen that compassion in the pulpit, they'll then come and say, with great embarrassment, and just sit and listen, Pastor, you know, I have this problem. That's the way it usually goes. And there's stuttering, stammering. Sometimes they'll leave because they still can't come through with it and tell you. Other times they'll be able to get it out in some sort of tangential kind of way. The first thing you want to ask is, how long have you had this sexual orientation? How long have you had the fantasies? Don't use sexual orientation, just say fantasies. How long have you had these fantasies about other men? Question number one. And when did they begin? So how long do you think about women? Often, absolutely not ever a single lustful thought about a woman. And at that point, you know that you've got some problems. Never had a lustful thought about a woman. How long has this been going on? If it goes way back to the developing of sexuality, 10, 11, 12, adolescence, then again, you know that this person has significant disruption in the development in their family. So, they begin to feel alienated from other men, different from other men at the age of 7. Lonely and tremendous sadness about this, but desperately trying to hold on to relationships. You see, our whole theology of sex becomes relevant here. What is sex? Sex is a way to relate based on intimacy and closeness, hopefully. You know, agape, phileo, eros. Hopefully, it's the top of the triangle, that out of emotional love and agape love, erotic love is a natural outflowing of that when two people come together, the one flesh. Well, there's terrible confusion on the part of the homosexual about how all this works, and does it even work for him at all? So when he has a homosexual orientation, when he engages in homosexual behavior, he's desperately trying to maintain some connectedness with other human beings. And to him, or to her, it seems that the only safe way to relate is to relate to a person of the same sex. So they feel alienated, cut off from relationships, and different. Often the male homosexual will be saying at this point that he used to play with dolls or used to have friends in the neighborhood that were girls, but always avoided being with other men. Depression, again, anxiety. Terrible anxiety about themselves. How are they going to cope in a male world when they're male? Loneliness. And usually a high amount of guilt. Guilt, and especially in the Christian community. Now let me just refer again to Nicolosi's book. He distinguishes here between the gay community, which is very, very powerful, as I said earlier. One of the most powerful lobbies. I don't need to tell you probably that more money is spent on AIDS research than on cancer research or heart disease research, which is rather astounding since it's a preventable disease. And cancer and heart disease, while they may be somewhat preventable, aren't really preventable. More money spent on the AIDS population, less than 3% homosexuals, than on cancer or heart disease. So you see the power of their lobby. Many people are gay because they're political gays. It gives them some kind of a meaning and identity. You get into it deeper with them and you see that they're not really true gays at all. But Nicolosi talks about the gay community. This is an excellent book, readable by the non-psychologist, Reparative Therapy of Male Homosexuality by Joseph Nicolosi. I would be almost certain that he's a Christian. He founded the Thomas Aquinas Psychological Clinic. I've been told that he is a Christian. I don't know him personally. He is on that 2020 interview where he was really picked apart. Then he talks about the disenfranchised gays, the disenfranchised homosexuals, he calls them. And you see, that's the population to which we in the church have to respond. There's people out there who want to come to their pastor, but they feel they can't because they're going to be judged. And even if he's compassionate and caring, he's not going to understand the intricacies of what I'm struggling with. And they're probably right on that. It's a terrible, terrible struggle, especially if they're going to try and give it up. So again, I would commend you this book. The only thing he does in here, he says that the male homosexual didn't have a good male relationship with his father, and through homosexual relations, he's trying to repair that. Female didn't have a good relationship with her mother, and through homosexual relations with another female, she's trying to repair that. That's true, but there's a level below it. It's much deeper. And let's go into this, and then we'll stop and have questions. Okay, there's depression, anxiety, loneliness, and guilt. Now, the father of the male, let's say the male homosexual, the patterns are almost the same. A little different thing happens inside. But the father of the male homosexual isn't there. Either he's absent, or he's passive, or just totally hostile and therefore alienated from the son. But the son, for whatever reason, often, almost always, doesn't have a relationship with the father. In all of the people I've seen through the 25 years, what I'm telling to you now, I've never seen an exclusion to it. I've seen it in every case. Everyone I've talked to has always seen the same clinical picture. We in the psychoanalytic camp tend to be put down that we're out of touch and all this. Yeah, but when you work with it year after year and you find the same patterns, they're unique to each person, but these same patterns, which we're now discussing, in the makeup of the particular person and their struggles, it doesn't take you too long to believe it. Because they're the ones that are talking about it. There's a very deficient, if there is a relationship at all with the father, it's very deficient. Now, the relationship with the mother, however, is something different. So this is cut off. But the relationship with the mother is along these lines. Usually a very, very dominant, invasive, controlling lady. Often she'll negate or demean the father, call him bad names, talk to the son about how bad he is, about his deficiencies in bed and other things like that. Often there's a very strong message that you will not be close to your father. And often the male homosexual was forbidden. Very, very covertly. I'm not talking about conscious messages about you will not relate to your father. It's much more subtle than that. Unconscious communications. But you will not have a relationship with your father. You will only relate to me. And so we get this picture of this very controlling, dominating, invasive mother who keeps the child, the male child, bonded to herself and does not allow separation, individuation. Okay? It's absolutely crucial that the mother keeps the child bonded, attached to herself, forbids relationship with the father, says you will have no relationship or pleasure that does not include me. No relationship, no pleasure that I'm not part of, including your dad. And so the child then, you see, feels helpless. He has to acquiesce to the demands of the mother. Now he can't separate and he can't individuate and become a male. The research shows that an aggressive father, by the way, we don't know we're men till probably three. We don't realize there's a difference between men, males, females. At three and four, for sure, we knew we were male. See, at age of 3 to 4, the father has got to become a dominant influence in the male child's life and bond with the child to help the child as a bridge out of this oneness with the mother. And I'm talking about normal development. Well, naturally, if the father isn't there and the mother is holding on, very, very controlling again, saying you will not have a relationship that doesn't include me, she's in complete control of the child. And so the male child, you see, can't frolic with mates at recess because he feels too weak. I'm not one of them anyway. I can't even have a relationship with anybody that doesn't include mother. So the sense of isolation, cut-offness, aloneness, and only belonging to and being possessed by mother becomes a huge factor at this point. So there's a suppression of any attempt to move. We should stop, shouldn't we? No? 5 minutes. 5 more minutes, and we'll stop. Suppression of any attempt to become a male or to become a separate person from mother because she is so able to create guilt. Now, I probably sounds like I'm being unfair to women. No, there's an equal responsibility. Again, Reckers, who's a Christian, has done incredible amount of research with other people showing that the aggressive father can go in and snap the child out and save and salvage the child from this bonded symbiosis, connectedness with the mother. But if there is no such male to do that, you see, the child is left helpless and he has to suppress any attempts to become separate. So he soon learns that any move toward being assertive on his own behalf, he doesn't do anything creative because it gets criticized. And, you know, this is not, again, overt, it's covert. Just a glance of disapproval. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't try to succeed on your own apart from me. You shouldn't move toward that friend. Just a disapproving glance or a sneer. The child has no chance to make it. And so this then, you see, creates an internal picture which is far deeper than depression and anxiety and loneliness. The guilt factor is just huge. There's no way, you see, that I can escape the guilt that I'm given if I'm not talking about moral or biblical guilt. I'm talking about psychological or false guilt. Shame. You know, I'm so shamed, told that I'm bad or inadequate because mom said you're not to ever not be there for me. You're to be there to take care of me. A common theme in homosexual males. I had to be there to take care of my mother. My father wasn't there. He was an SOB. I had to be there for her. So they're locked in to this very, very arrested development. Here's the bottom line. They're locked into an arrested development, usually at a very infantile level. And you see, they're desperately trying to maintain relationships and sexuality at the same time. And then it gets channeled into male, or it can be channeled into female objects. But usually, because the mother is so controlling, it gets channeled into, I'm only safe with someone like myself, another infant and another male infant. That's the only relationship that I'm safe with. I'm talking about now as they're teenagers, they emerge out of the family, they go to school, but inwardly they still feel like they're infantile, and they are in many ways. And so these infantile needs and this lack of development gets attached to other boys like themselves. They can sniff. Have you ever noticed the way it boggles your mind, but as they go through malls and so forth, these homosexual people can spot each other a mile off. As I go through malls, I try to, you know, to do this, and occasionally I can see some guy really looking at me, and then I get all flustered and embarrassed and, you know, take my son's hand and show my wedding ring and, you know, get out. But it's amazing. They know, just like that. There's an unspoken language between them because it's such an infantile communication. We can't hook into it, because it's something we've developed far beyond. But they can spot each other instantly. Now, let me just conclude with the church's response. How do we respond to this? The disenfranchised homosexual, they're in the DSM-3, the statistical manual that we have to use in our profession for insurance and diagnostic reasons. Now the only thing in there is the ego-dystonic homosexual. It's
ego. It's against what he wants, and he wants to change. Well, the church should throw open its arms to these folks. And probably, if you ask those two questions, what is your real orientation, your fantasy, if it's primarily same-sex, never been anything else but, how long has this been there that goes way back, then there's a need for referral. You do not want, as a pastor, to try to take on that kind of problem. It involves intensive therapy that gets back into, see, this relationship with the mother and the father, especially as you go deeper into the relationship with the mother, you're going to hit terrible depression. Depression that may at times require hospitalization. You don't want to have to deal with that from a pastoral perspective. So it's better to refer them if you ask those two questions and get those kind of answers. If it's more of a bisexual or fleeting thing, you might want to investigate it more deeply. But we're going to have a tremendous onslaught from the political gay community. But we need to keep in our mind that there's a bigger group of disenfranchised people who have the homosexual orientation, and they didn't ask for that. They did not ask for it. They didn't want it. They don't want it. They didn't ask for it. It was brought about by factors in their background which arrested their development and forced them to the only kind of relationships which they were capable of. Now, they're responsible not to act out their behavior, not to act it out. And they're also, I think, taking the theme of responsibility from a Christian perspective, it seems to me, not only are they responsible to not act it out, but they're also responsible to try and change the orientation. It can be done. There are Christian homosexual groups, and I have here some literature from one of them. They have put out these brochures about expert after expert, non-Christian experts, who show conclusively that male homosexuals, female homosexuals, can change. Bieber and his study that came out in 88, 106 homosexuals, male homosexuals, and the fact that under intense psychotherapy they were able to change their orientation and have fulfilling marriages. Not that they didn't have problems at times, but basically they were, quote, cured. So we, as the church, need to not equate this group with the political gays whom we're going to have to forcibly take on. You know, narcissistic kids throw temper tantrums, they get their way, they're often bright, they're often very successful. That's our challenge. That's what Paul is talking about in Romans 1. But there's a whole other group that sit in the pew, that listen to your preaching, that want you to relate to them, that want to change, and they go through hell, literally changing. And that's the group that we can respond to and want to respond to and want to help. And by God's grace and the power of forgiveness and the eradication of guilt and the positive homosexual role model in Christ, and also hopefully we as pastors and other Christians, hopefully we can bring about a significant reorienting of their personality. And let me assure you, it's not genetic, and there can be changed, period. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, my name is David Ritok, and I am afraid to tell you that flashing your wedding ring is not enough anymore. I'm very well acquainted with a couple that my wife and I know very well. They've been married 11 years and have three children between 2 and 6 or 7 years of age. From the outside, they look like the model Christian family. They belong to a Missouri Synod church in Rhode Island. And after 11 years of marriage, he announced 6 months ago that he's been gay since 6 months before they were married. He's been very comfortable with this. He said the reason he got married in the first place was because he always wanted a family and children, and he would like to continue this lifestyle yet remain married. And obviously she said, no way. Is this a common thing that happens where gays are in fact married? And also, How do you respond to this man? He really believes that it's okay to be a homosexual and be a Christian because I think of a lot of the propaganda that he's getting from the gay community, and I'd sure like to hear your response.
Okay, fine. First, to the second question first. We all have tendencies, predispositions to different things. Many of us, I'm sure, have tendencies toward heterosexual fantasies and adulterous relationships, and it's our responsibility not to act on those. Well, you know, morals aren't decided by pleasure or the lack of pleasure. Morals and values come from the Word of God. And how he says he can be a Christian and be a homosexual defies my exegesis. I don't. John Stott's booklet on homosexual partners, I think it is excellent. And I say I have a paper here that it was given at one of our conventions by the director of the Christian Association for Psychological Studies, trying to justify from Romans 1 that it's all right. Their line of reasoning goes, we're not among those people. We don't worship the creature rather than the Creator. We're not the godless. We go to church. We go to the Metropolitan Church here in town or whatever. We love God, but we can also love each other and have a male relationship. And again, I think we need to be sensitive to these folks because they're really struggling. Beneath all this ridiculous, narcissistic-coded presentation, which is a turnoff. I mean, there was a missionary here in town that it's no secret, it's out in the open, so I can tell you, after years in the field, grown children, he announces that both he and his son are gay, he dissolves his marriage relationship, and he's now practicing here, he and his son together, not partners together, but they're practicing homosexuals in the homosexual community after years of missionary service in the Presbyterian Church. They're very arrogant, and again, that's this sense of entitlement that goes with narcissism. So don't be thrown off by their initial presentation, because prove it biblically. You know, again, it can't be proven. Now, the first one was this individual case. Yes, there's lots of this, and you have to look at it in terms of the individual. I would not want to answer. I'd just be armchairing it. There can be a suppression of the homosexual influence, the homosexual orientation enough, but the very fact that he can have relationships with women, I would say, means that he's accepting a lot of the propaganda, wants to cop out, maybe doesn't want the responsibilities of a family. I'm just guessing again. I wouldn't fall for that. I would say, okay, we want to go into this in depth, but you cannot be a member of the church and maintain this behavior. That has got, you're not doing that. You're not doing an infant any favor by allowing them to live out their infantile impulses. And we're not doing the homosexual any favor by allowing them to practice and sit there every Sunday as members of the church in good standing.
Concerning homosexual couples.
Is this microphone on? It is? Okay. In the different homosexuals that I've met, there's something that I've observed that I'm not sure is true or not, but it always seems that when you have a homosexual couple, whether male or female, one of them ends up playing a male role and the other one ends up playing a female role. Case in point was a friend of mine whose wife is a Lutheran school teacher had a parent-teacher conference where these two women came in as the parents of this little boy who had been trying to explain to his teacher that he had a mom and a dad mom. And when they came in, one was dressed in a dress, long hair, like a woman. The other one came in, pants, leather jacket, hair cropped short with, you know, half a dozen earrings.
Right.
Is this a yes. common characteristic?
Yeah, good question. By the way, you know, you've probably seen that in New York, all the elementary school children are having to read the new book, Daddy's New Roommate, and there's a female equivalent book, Mommy's New Mommy or something, I forget that one. But yes, in the homosexual relationship, one is dominant and one is submissive. And of course, they're all submissive, basically, especially the male, submissive to the mother. I may have not used that word, but that's a key word. They're submissive and compliant, always doing what mother commands. So there is an interesting shift. They usually switch. Now, occasionally you do get, quote, what's called the dyke, who is the male-oriented lesbian, taking on a male role. Often these girls, you see, have a very pathological relationship with the father, and identified with the father often because the mother was this engulfing and sometimes real weak, and needed in her weakness to have the child there to hold her up, the female child to hold her up, or the male child. So that they switch roles. One's the butch and one's the femme. Those are the official words for it. The butch and the femme. And they'll usually change around. Often you get, again, this leather jacket female that wants the male role, and that becomes very obvious.
This may be a relatively easy question to answer. What do you tell somebody who is either preparing for full-time Christian work or is already, say, a teacher, elder, or pastor, and they say that they have been a homosexual for all their lives, but they don't practice it? I mean, should they forget about ministry altogether because they're a hopeless case and they'll just be a detriment to others, or should we treat them like we would treat an alcoholic or some other type of sin-caused addiction? What would you recommend?
Okay. Alcoholism is a good parallel. You know, a lot of people are predisposed to alcoholism because of the way they metabolize alcohol, and they have to be careful that their biological makeup doesn't cause them to be alcoholic. Same thing with the predisposition to homosexuality, but they're not born with a gene that says you're going to be an alcoholic. I forgot your question.
Should we tell them that they should exit the ministry, or
No, but I would say let's see how therapy goes. If they've been, you said, homosexual all their lives, if they're that deeply into it, the chances are that they probably shouldn't be considering the ministry, certainly not before this is dealt with and looked at in depth. And is it going to be changeable?
One more.
I'm just wondering if you could make a few comments about your professional peers, because I'm getting the impression that the majority, although there are Christians who would agree with you, that the majority of them would probably side with the what's being put out by the media. And the reason I ask that is because many of us are going to be going out into places where we're going to have a hard time maybe finding somebody. I'm just wondering if you think it's prevalent among your professional peer
groups?
Yes,
I'd say 95% of mental health professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, psychoanalysts, counselors, would agree that this is the way you're born, and their whole aim in therapy is to get the person to accept it. Accept it and work with it. And most of the books are heading in that direction. So let's say you and I are partners, we would go for therapy and the person would help us communicate better and learn better to live with each other.
Is there, as pastors, would you recommend then that we try to find or locate somebody? I realize if that's the case, that means that in a sense a lot of times it's just going to be put on our shoulders. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah, you're going to have a hard time finding mental health professionals who don't buy the line that this is genetic, don't struggle with it, accept it. And Christians, by the way, take that position. The psychoanalytic community is the best place to look, because they might say homosexuality isn't a sin morally, but the psychoanalytic community will, without question, see it as an arrested development and a deficient way to live. So go to a depth-oriented, psychodynamic, psychoanalytically-oriented therapist, and there you'll find your best ally in every area. The psychoanalytic community goes deep into human nature, the way God created it, and it's not surprising that often they come out as our closest allies in a lot of these deep issues, feminism, homosexuality, AIDS, all these things. They're very close to us because they deal with things in such depth. I was asked to comment on your human sexuality paper statement. Let me just say it's excellent. Excellent.
What he was referring to was the CTCR document, which he also reviewed in preparation, and his comments were that it is an excellent document. We thank Dr. Kerwin for being with us to discuss this sensitive subject with us, but one that we will have to deal with in the ministry. Thank you for being with us today.